America. He's author of the book Brainwashed, Challenging the Myth of Black Inferiority. In it, he argues that we are not living in a post-racial era, but one that makes it increasingly difficult to talk about race. In order to solve some of the problems that plague the black community, he says that both members of black and white communities need to understand that, quote, black people are not just dark-skinned white people.
African Americans are very unique in that they came to this country in a totally different way from everybody else. They didn't come here seeking freedom. They came here in bondage, came here against their will. As a result of coming to this country enslaved, that led to a whole different set of psychological, sociological circumstances that manifested in a lot of different kinds of attitudes and behaviors. And at the time that I said that, I was saying it in the context of African-American consumers and basically saying that as a result of not being dark-skinned, white people, our purchasing habits are quite different. Our patterns are quite different. The things that we prefer to buy, how we prefer to buy them, how we make purchasing decisions are largely tied to those basic differences in how we got here.
I've read in your book, you refer to that as a buy now, pay later mentality.
Well, buy now, pay later. Yes, that's one of the manifestations of the problem. When we came to this country, we came pretty much stripped of everything that we had had: our customs, our names, our rituals, our family, and we were left with nothing except propaganda that said that we were less than, that we were inferior. And so in this society, which is largely driven by materialism, what we have been striving to do since we came to these shores is basically try to buy back the somebody-ness that we lost. And in a materialistic society, how do you do it? You do it by material. Gaining material, buying the best brands that you can come up with, top name, luxury brand names that we adorn ourselves with to try to say to ourselves and to each other and to the society at whole, yes, we are somebody. We are not what you said that we were, or not what you say that we are.
You talk about how this inferiority complex plays out in lots of ways, including in classrooms and education. Can you tell me a little bit more about that, too?
Well, you know, one of in order to justify slavery in a democracy, which, of course, is a profound contradiction, one of the things that had to be basically drilled into the people who the oppressor was seeking to keep under control is the fact that they were inferior. Part of that inferiority is to imbue them with those people with lower goals and lower expectations. So the idea of the myth of black inferiority can be reinforced, and they can feel reassured that everything is going to be all right, because we start playing into the roles that are assigned to us. So you get lower. We have in the chapter D's Will Do quite a discussion on this whole issue of lower goals and lower expectations.
This has roots hundreds of years ago. In your book, you wrote that the first ads in the country were advertising for black slaves. Is that right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How do you think those...
Slave posters, yes.
Right. Do you think that that is what started the whole myth of inferiority that you talk about?
Well, the myth of inferiority had basically started somewhere back even before the founding of the nation, and it certainly got started in 1619 when we started coming to the shores. But it had to be codified, it had to be regulated, it had to be put into some kind of formulaic formation in order to institutionalize it. And so that's when it started. It started, you know, we have to basically keep a broad definition of the term media, because in those days, I mean, any form of communications from a source to a group of people really constitutes media. So books were media, posters were media, postcards were media, religious texts were media. And in those texts and in the interpretation of those texts, the idea of blacks being inferior was very clearly, repeatedly stated.
You know, you've had a very successful career as an ad man. Do you think it's possible that there could be a counter campaign to bust that myth? Or,
well,
culturally, is that possible?
I want to believe that. That's really what the book is all about. The possibility of a solution lies in the availability of media through technology, through the development of technology. And we now have at our disposal means of communicating that we never had before. The computer, the internet, we can now get if we don't even have a computer, we can get a library card and go in to get access to a computer. We can start developing our own media messaging and start developing our own, quote, positive propaganda. That is the promise. That is the hope, that we can take advantage of the new media to start developing positive images to counter the slew of negative images that we're being bombarded with every day.
How would you judge success for that advertising campaign?
Well, there's only one way for me to judge success. When we see a change in the results right now, because of this onslaught of negative media, we have basically, a society has been basically convinced at both ends, whites and blacks, that white people are superior and black people are inferior. And we see that played out every day. And we look at the figures, and we look at figures having to do with crime and delinquency and educational levels, dropout rates, homicide, ill health, obesity, other diseases, economic power. And we see that we're still, as African Americans, at the bottom of the good list and at the top of the bad list. The only manifestation that I want to see is I want to see a reversal. I want to see us at the top of the good list and at the bottom of the bad list. When we get to the point where we can say that African Americans are among the highest scores on the SAT, when we can say that we have some of the lowest homicide rates, the lowest out of wedlock birth rates, teenage pregnancy rates, all of the things now that we're basically playing into the role that was assigned to us. When we get to a point where we can reverse that, then we'll know we will have achieved success.
Thomas, thank you very much for coming in to talk with us today.
My pleasure.
Thomas Burrell is the founder and CEO of Burrell Communications. He's giving a talk this evening on campus at 7:30 p.m. in Knight Auditorium. You're listening to The Afternoon Magazine on WILL. I'm Lindsay Moon.
WILL programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe. Bevere Cafe serves breakfast and lunch from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. Monday through Friday. Daily menus are available online at bevercafe.illinois.edu. Bevere offers Wi-Fi and is staffed and managed by students. Bevere Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday, the 11th of April, 2013. It's the birthday of Marguerite de Navarre, born in Angoulême, France, 1492. She was the daughter of a count and a mother with high aspirations for her children, so Marguerite learned Latin, Spanish, Hebrew, and Italian. She read philosophy, read the scriptures. Her younger brother Francis became the king of France, and he'd always looked up to his big sister, so he asked her to join his court, and she did, and she advised him on all sorts of things, on diplomatic affairs, and why he should employ Leonardo da Vinci and Benvenuto Cellini at the royal court, and why he should try to reform the Catholic Church. She tried to mediate the religious conflict between Catholics and Protestants and to protect reformers like John Calvin, even though she didn't agree with him. It's the birthday of Dorothy Allison, born Greenville, South Carolina, 1949. Grew up desperately poor, but she was inspired by the confidence that her teachers and classmates had in her. She said, because they did not see poverty and hopelessness as a foregone conclusion for my life, I could begin to imagine other futures for myself. She was the first person in her family to go to college, and there in the late 60s, she was introduced to the feminist movement, which she said was like opening your eyes underwater. Wrote a memoir about her childhood and family history called Two or Three Things I Know for Sure, and wrote a novel, Bastard Out of Carolina, which she's best known for. Dorothy Allison, who said, people want biography, people want memoir. They want you to tell them that the story you're telling them is true. The thing I'm telling you is true, but it did not always happen to me. Here's a poem for today by Stephen Dunn, entitled Wild. The year I owned a motorcycle and split the air in southern Spain and could smell the oranges in the orange groves as I passed them outside of Seville, I understood I'd been riding too long in cars, probably even should get a horse, become a high-up, flesh-connected thing among the bulls and cows. My brand-new wife had a spirit that worried and excited me, a history of moving on. Wine from a spigot for pennies, langoustinas and angulas, even the language felt dangerous in my mouth. Mornings, our icebox bereft of ice, I'd speed on my motorcycle to the iceman's house, strap a big rectangular block to the extended seat where my wife often sat, hot behind me, arms around my waist. In the streets, the smell of olive oil, the noise of men torn between church and